Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, episode 96, with Jim Zaspel on hiring, managing, and firing contractors. I'm Dan Breslin, host of the REI Diamond Show, and on today's discussion with my friend Jim, we will cover how to hire, find, fire, if necessary, the contractors to complete the work on your rehab projects. Jim currently has 21 rehab projects going on in the greater Philadelphia region and has completed more than 150 rehab projects in the last 3 years alone. He has some fantastic insights and systems he's going to share. So if you're rehabbing houses, want to get started rehabbing houses, maybe you've done one or two, maybe you've done 100, you should probably pause this right now and grab a pen and pad to take notes. I'm already rehabbing a ton of properties throughout the United States and have been since 2006, and I just took 3 pages of notes while recording this episode. Point is, solid lessons here, and you can learn from them without losing $20,000. More on that from Jim shortly. Shall we dive in? Welcome back to the REI Diamond Show, Jim Zaspel. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. Super excited to be here with you.
Yeah, me too. We had done an episode of discussion a while back, you and I, maybe a year or so, and we talked about deal sources, so I'll make sure I put a reference in that link, and if anyone wants to kind of hear your background story, they can go back and check out that other episode. But for listeners who are tuning in now for the first time or maybe did tune in and just looking for an update on Jim Zaspel, can you give us an idea of kind of what your business has grown into today, let's say in the last 12 to 24 months, Jim?
Sure, man. I appreciate it. But first of all, you know, you're doing pretty dang good yourself. I can't fathom the number of closings you do per month, especially the handful of markets that you're in. So you're absolutely crushing it, my friend. I remember several years ago, you know, we weren't green, but we were kind of growing up the business together, and you've definitely gone on to crush it. So kudos to you. It's awesome. But with regards to our business, so, you know, 5 years ago, I was at a point in my life where I had to, you know, move from one area in the niche of the business to rehabbing. And in 2013, I did a few rehabs, and 9 the next year, 38 the next, 47 the next, and then 58 last year. And we're shooting for, we'll hit 75 or 80 rehabs this year, and then we do about a wholesale deal a week or so. So that's our scale, our volume, what we do. My wife's an agent, and she does pretty well at that. Works like 3 or 4 half days a week. Kind of makes me jealous sometimes, to be honest with you. But now we're super happy with things are.
Cool. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate the kind words there. And I did want everybody to just kind of pay attention to those numbers. 5 years, you got 9 rehabs, then you know, more than tripled to 30, 47, then 58 rehabs, and then you're expecting to be on target to do 75 rehabs. So, you know, that's a great segue into the topic here, which I knew you were going to be perfect for, and that's like, you know, dealing with contractors. Everybody in the audience, whether you're a private investor who's investing in an investor like yourself or me, doing a rehab somewhere in there is the risk of the contractors. Are they being managed properly? Are you finding the right contractors? You have to understand, you know, does this person have the ability to manage contractors? If someone in the audience is a fix and flipper, there's probably going to be some, you know, little tidbits and tips and nuggets we're going to talk about on this episode from the experience of well over, what, maybe 150, 160 deals or so that you've been a part of, Jim. So I wanted everybody to hear that experience so they know that, you know, you're not new to the scene and you're doing a large number of deals. So that we can get another piece of background, how many rehabs are going right now as we record this podcast in February 2018?
We just had our construction meeting, and we've sold a bunch in the last few months. So right now, I think we have 21 under construction, 20 or 21 under construction. And then, but what we typically operate is in the 30 to 50 range. I think right now it's, you know, like 36. So it's a little light right now, but 30 to 50 range of rehabs in the works. So that's either we're under contract to buy, under construction, listed, sitting on the market, or under contract to sell. So those 4 categories combined, we stay in the 30 to 50 swing.
And I'm sure there's a million systems for a variety of the pieces of the process, but today we're going to focus just on the contractor piece of that. So how many crews are we dealing with to run this number of rehabs? Can you maybe just kind of map out what it looks like for you to manage these contractors a little bit, Jim?
Yeah, definitely. So there's, in my opinion, there's, you can kind of break down the construction model in our business. And Dan, you and I have a lot of friends in this business, and there's, you know, we've learned from lots of different people. There's three, really, in my opinion, three models. One of my good friends, Josh Hertz, and he has employees who are swinging the hammers, and he might sub out one or two or three trades per project, right? That's a fine model. It's great. For me, I don't want that. It's too management intensive. My friend Josh figured it out. It's great. And lots of guys do that. But that's a great way, if you can manage it, to save costs. But like I said, labor intensive from a management side of things. That's model one. Model two is basically you sub out all the trades, the floor and the drywall, the painting, the kitchens, bathrooms, roofing, siding, that kind of stuff, right? So you might have 5 to 10 tradesmen subs per project, and then maybe a GC to do some framing and a GC to do finished carpentry, right? That's actually, in my opinion, if you can swing it, maybe the ideal model, but it's not the one I use. The model that I use, and I'll explain why in a second, is the general contractor model. So we have 3 points of contact in every job. We've got the cleaning lady, the landscaper, and the GC. That's it. Sometimes we throw in a septic guy or a driveway guy, but usually we'll even let the GCs manage that. So, you know, the reason I like it is I can hold one person's feet to the fire, right, to get the job done. I've done it in the past where I'm sourcing for tradesmen, and, you know, it's like, oh, well, he was supposed to do that. No, the painter, or no, the drywall guy. It's just all that back and forth. I don't like it. I guess the other reason, two other reasons, one, to be quite honest with you, when I really got serious about rehabbing houses 5 years ago, I didn't have the experience or the technical knowledge to be able to effectively source the tradesmen, right? And so I've learned a ton, honestly, from my GCs and by virtue of doing, you know, 150, 200 flips in the last several years, simply by virtue of learning it. So one, hold their feet to the fire. Two, I didn't know how. And then three, or how to source the tradesmen earlier on. And then three, now, you're looking back, it's kind of easier to grow quickly if you hire GCs, the right GCs, right? But, you know, picture if I had 10 or 12 points of contact for every project, how much more management intensive, and then I have to spend more time managing contractors than actually doing the revenue generating stuff, which you and I both know is getting deals, right? Or running a company. So that's the model we use. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure where you want to go from there.
Yeah, it does. I've never heard it broken down and never looked at it in my own life. So like my own, you know, 2006, when I did my first renovation, like when I was a kid, Jim, I was kind of the opposite and I had all the technical knowledge. I think my first toys that I can remember at like 6 years old, my dad bought like, or gave me from his toolbox, like a razor, some wire strippers, and like a 6 foot length of 12-2 wire, and like a couple of outlets and switches. And I'd wire them up, you know, for fun.
That's cool.
You know, change out my first circuit panel at the age of like 12 or 13 years old, as that was like working with dad, you know, heading out to the job site, working in new construction. So I was used to doing that stuff. It's cool, but the challenge is, and I'm sure we have some people listening who can relate to this, is that when I got into the first, you know, handful of rehabs, 6, 8, 10 rehabs, I would do I would try to sub out. But what would happen, Jim, is I would think, oh, no, this guy's, you know, $4,500 for the wiring here. This is too expensive. I could just do it myself. And then I would spend the next week and a half wiring everything. So I'd always have this temptation to run back, grab the tools, and just knock things out. Now, that was great when it was like, you know, home inspections and we got a settlement on Friday and it's like Wednesday night and they call us out on a GFI or something of that. I can go in there and handle that, or I could, you know, certainly find somebody capable of it now. But so, it, you know, it was a blessing and a curse a little bit, which I've also graduated to the GC model myself. And like, as you were making these notes, I was making notes. I had the management all in-house, Josh Hertz. I'll put a link in the show notes to Josh's interview as well. Maybe we could get him back on the show at some point. Listeners probably recognize his name. And then you have the subbing out of everything. So in a sense, that second business model, you're a little bit more expensive than the first business model. And you're in a really acting like a GC because you're the guy who's pulling in all the trades and coordinating everything. And then the third model, I don't think you actually said it, but in my own experience, it's been a little more expensive because I'm paying this other guy a little bit of a middleman fee. And, you know, the way I've gotten myself to accept that, you know, I like holding one person's feet to the fire, especially when I go into a new market, Jim. I get to Chicago and I know nobody. So it's like I was reliant on one person who had been here I was in Philadelphia for, you know, 25, 30 years. Like, we grew up on the job site. I had subs because I was working with those guys as a teenager. I didn't have that luxury when I got to Chicago. It forced me to look at the GC model. And I now, in a sense, I view that GC almost like a partner on the deal. I have a lot of partners on a lot of deals, and I kind of stomach my higher cost there and get over my own, oh, I can just do this myself and save money, irrational way of operating, by like viewing my GC as, okay, this guy's probably going to make, you know, a few grand, maybe even 10 or 15 grand on this deal or more, depending on the construction. But in a sense, he's my partner, and I'm counting on him, trusting and relying on this GC as much as I'd be relying on myself if I brought the cash to the table, or an investor on that deal who brought cash to the table. Like, these are all equal and important pieces of the deal, if not, you know, even more important pieces. When you start to do volume and have 21 under construction, it could turn into a nightmare very quickly. So I do want to ask you, as you, you know, keep these volume of deals running, like, how do you find the GC in the first place? How many GCs do you have? Maybe you could tell the story of how you found one or two, or if you have a system for attracting these GCs, or did God simply place the right people in your life at the right time, Jim?
Well, it's kind of a little bit of everything. So I'll tell you a story, a contrasting story. My first GC, his name is Scott. It was my first project I did like a year into the business. I mean, I had no business rehabbing a house. I didn't know Jack Diddley, right? So I was so smart that when, you know, project number one was getting a little slow, I went in a contract to buy another house, which honestly was a terrible deal. And, you know, I let Scott talk me into being the GC on that house as well. And so he screwed me. He had a 20 grand or so on each project, so 40 grand combined. And so that was my first one. I forget how I found him. I think I met him at a RIA meeting, right, which is actually a great way to meet contractors. So that was back then. So how to find them. So we've got four GCs that we work with right now on a consistent basis, which doesn't sound like a lot given the number of deals we're doing, but it works well. We've, in the last 6 months, I have tried and fired. And I'm sorry, we have five GCs we're working with. In the last 6 or 8 months, we have tried and fired two or three other GCs, right? Partway through the project, which honestly I'd never done in my life until, you know, like 6 months ago or so. So how do we find them? So go through Brian. So Phil, I actually was referred to him. I think my dad knows his dad. And we got the conversation. My dad happened to talk to his dad, said, hey, you know, Phil's does some handyman work. Turns out it's more than handyman work. But he does our light rehabs, right? So referral from my dad, mutual friend, right? So I guess I put that one under the God put him in my life category, right? And then next one, Brian, he's a great guy. My wife actually sourced him back before she and I even met, right? So it was her first duplex she had bought, and she was looking for a painter. She interviewed, get this, like 43 contractors, right?
Oh, my God.
43 contractors for this lipstick rehab and a duplex in Plymouth Meeting. But she found Brian. It was like her coworker's godson or something like that. He was the cheapest quote, and she felt that he was honest, and so she hired him, you know, to do some painting. And then she asked him, you know, do you do anything else? And he said, oh, yeah, of course. At the time, he never had, but he figured it out. So he kind of faked until he made it, but, you know, Brian is, you know, one of our two main GCs that we work with. Joel, it was a referral, actually, from Brian, which is interesting because Joel's more Jersey-focused, but he'll do PA once in a while, right? And then Feliciano, great guy. He's expensive as heck, but he does really good work and gets stuff done super fast, and super honest guy as well. He's my, you know, South Philly contractor, right? But he does a lot of stuff. I got him as a referral from a friend. So the way I got that referral was pretty straightforward. I got a house in South Philly. It was a good deal. I didn't have any South Philly contractors. So I texted like 10 or 12 different friends. And if you're listening to this and you're thinking to yourself, well, gosh, Jim, of course you can do this. You have all these friends in the business. Well, the way I made these friends was going to RIA meetings, right? And doing the business, right? And you can get friends in this business very, very easily. You can lose them very easily too if you're not careful. So anyway, texted like 10 or 12 friends. A few people texted back. Several didn't. Some texted back, said, I don't have anything for you. And then two or three texted back with a name and a number. I was like, sweet. So Feliciano is one of them. We'll talk about the pre-screening process later. And he's done several deals with us. He's just a super reliable guy. And then the fifth one, Mike. Mike has, I think, done the most projects with us. of any of the GCs. This is kind of a backdoor way to find good contractors, right? So I always, when I'm teaching this workshop or something like this, Dan, I'll do this role playing with the audience, right? I say, who here has bid on a house and, you know, gotten outbid by another investor or by gotten outbid by somebody else? And everybody raises their hand. I say, great. How many of those, who is it that buys those houses? Everybody says, well, investors. Okay. And what do they plan on doing with that house once they buy it? Well, and I see as many of those, fix the house. Who's going to do the work to fix the house? Well, a contractor. Great. So if you're making 30 offers a week and you get one deal, let's just use that ratio. If you're buying at the MLS, it's about that, right? So let's do, so you got 29 leads of good sources that within a month or two or three are going to have a contractor on site. And so that's how we found Mike, right? We got outbid on our property. So whenever I need a contract, that's kind of the ways we do it. We'll drive around where we're doing construction or, you know, go to some of the houses we've outbid, got outbid on a few months ago and go there and, you know, mix and mingle with one or two of the subs and find a GC and pre-screen them. So that's how we found each of our five current GCs.
Yeah, absolutely. For the most part, sounds like it's all referrals. And I think that's been one of my best sources as well, you know, running the networking events, seeing people come around. My first referrals came from, you know, the guy I met at the RIA meeting, and he had, I don't remember how many units, 20, 30, 80, 100, some astronomical number when you first get into the business. And it still is a pretty big number now. But I asked him who his window contractor was, and, you know, this guy had used him on 20 houses. And that guy, you know, to this day, he's still one of my best contractors for the referral. But you did have a very, very interesting way of going about finding the properties in the system that you shared. I think that's great. And if someone's listening and didn't write that down or it went over your head, going out to the properties where you were outbid. If somebody else paid more money than me for a rehab property, there's a chance they're getting the construction done for a lower number than me if they're managing to still squeak it out, make a profit, and somehow make that deal work. I can't think of a better pre-qualified method for, you know, cold calling on the contractors. I mean, that's head and shoulders above some of the stuff you hear, like go to the, you know, the stand out front of the Home Depot or whatever other crazy things that, you know, like you're playing the lottery with something like that. Jim, you mentioned pre-screen that the leads that you went to these properties where you were outbid and you said, pre-screen them. Can you talk about maybe you have a process for pre-screening the contractors? What's it look like before you hand them some money?
Yeah, so there's a two or three step process. So step number one is, you know, first I have to like the person, right? So if I or my project manager are stopping by the property, we're not saying, hey, I want to hire a contractor. Who's the contractor here, right? Because then they put on the BS mode, right? The schmooze mode sometimes. I want to say, oh, you know, I saw that this house sold. I figure you guys are doing some work. Let them talk to me a little bit. And yeah, you get a gut feeling with somebody. And that gut feeling is right more often than it's wrong. As long as you listen to it, you know what I mean? So that's the first level of pre-screening. Then if I like the person, they seem like a good person to do business with, then what I'll do is I'll tell them, say, you know, listen, I actually do some rehabs as well. We do a good number of them. Are you looking for more work? And I talk to them about how quickly we pay them, how, you know, all that kind of, all the stuff they want to hear, and which is true. And if they say no, then that's great. Then I might chase them a little bit more, right? And I'll press a little harder. If they say yes, I said, great. I said, you know, what we typically do is before we have them to bid out on a project, I have a one-page pre-screening checklist that I created for my project managers, my employees who interface with the GCs. I have a one-page checklist. They follow simple stuff like, you know, insurance, workman's comp, license, you know, double check, all that kind of stuff. And then we get references and we go to the projects, right? And I want to get the address of the projects, maybe addresses of completed projects if they've been doing work for, you know, for flippers, for rehabbers like me. So I'm big on that. And a lot of times you get pushback on that. But if I get any pushback whatsoever, then they're immediately on my blacklist. I'll never hire them immediately. Right. So when I go to their projects or my PM goes to their projects, there's a few things we're looking for. Right. What I'm not looking for is the aesthetics of the property. I'm not looking, oh, were the tile selections good, the flooring or the paint. That's not what I'm looking for. Because maybe the owner of the property kind of forced their hand. Right. And honestly, most contractors, I guess it's a guy thing. Most contractors, their design skills suck. Like they have no idea. I mean, I still don't know the difference between a cold and a warm color. But so I don't put any stock in there. design ability. But one thing I am looking for is the quality of workmanship. You know, specifically, the doors close right. The drawers open and close properly. Are all the light bulbs, you know, working, right? Are the paint corners cut in well? Is the tile perfectly straight and perfectly level, right? Now, are there any gaps, you know, inordinate gaps in the trim? You know, all that, the detailed stuff, right? Because face it, we only have so much to go off of, right? We don't have that much to go off, so you got to go off of what you have. And what I have is the stuff, you know, in front of the walls. And the stuff in front of the walls is, you know, some corners were cut here and there. I've got to wonder if the stuff behind the walls is going to be corners cut as well, which, by the way, is a noteworthy point that if I'm thinking that way, guess what? So are our buyers, right? And so that final 2 or 3% of a project, how do you want to quantify that? Here's what I tell my PMs. I say, listen, when you go to a property, I want you to take your time and slow down and walk through there as the buyer. And not, get this, I said, be skeptical, because guess what? Our buyers are too. Our buyers are more skeptical. Buyers are more skeptical of a house that has had $80,000 of work done to it than a house that hasn't been touched in 20 years, right? And so they're looking for reasons to be scared of the workmanship and therefore not write an offer, right? And so you know, if there's, I don't know, one light switch that doesn't seem to do anything, a door that doesn't close quite right, and the lock doesn't work quite right, like it's, you have almost zero chance of selling that house to that buyer. So that's kind of our, now later in the podcast, I'll give your listeners an opportunity to get that checklist for free. But that's kind of the nuts and bolts. There's some other stuff as well. But that's our pre-screening process. And then, of course, after all that, there's a bidding process, right? And their bids have to be somewhat in line with our budget.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. So let's talk about how to manage them. I heard you mention project manager a few times. Are you personally going out, you know, and interviewing these contracts? Does the project manager do that? Can you just talk about, you know, some of that day-to-day?
Yeah. So anymore, I'm not personally managing or interviewing a contractor until they've gone through all of those phases and my PM recommends them. Once my PM recommends them, gone through all those phases described, then I have them over to the office or meet them on a job site and go meet them and chat with them and see if they pass my muster test, you know, my sniff test. That's my process, right? Then for managing them, you know, let me describe how it used to be. The way it used to be was the GCs would text me. Back when I had like, you know, 5 to 15 projects going out of time. GC would text me, hey, I should be ready for draw B, you know, on Thursday. So can you come check it out by Wednesday? So I can give me a check on Thursday. And it was just so haphazard, right? It was in our independent contract agreements, it spells out what work's got to get done in order for the next draw, and it quantifies how much that draw is, right? But it was just so haphazard. So I was running all over the place, spending 2 or 3 full days a week going to construction projects. And then I thought, well, I need a project manager. I need somebody to go interface with the GCs and to go to these projects for me. But it was the same thing, just as haphazard, but instead of going to the house, I would just watch a video. So then I spent about a day a week watching these freaking videos of these updates. And it was always like, you know, urgent, need it right now, now, now. And finally, one day, I was like, I've had enough of this shit, right? I've had enough of this. And I said, here's the way it's going to work. Every Wednesday at 1 p.m., we have a project management meeting, right? And the checks will be ready at and no sooner than 10 a.m. on Thursday. And for the check that you're requesting for Thursday morning, the work has to be completed by the end of Sunday. So then we fell into a weekly rhythm, and it works great. So no matter how many projects we have going, I personally don't spend more than 1 to 4 hours a week dealing with construction. It's pretty incredible. So my weekly rhythm is this. So 1 to 3 p.m. on Wednesdays is kind of like the climax of the week. We just had our meeting here today. And the way the meeting works is it's a briefing meeting, right? So I have what I used to find, again, you learn through all these, looking back, it feels silly, right? I would just go through our spreadsheet, a pipeline of deals, and come up with questions to ask about each property. One day I realized I asked the same stinking questions every single time on every property. Why don't I standardize this? So I put it on just a one-page, you know, document and just a bunch of questions. You know, how much money have we paid so far? What's the total cost of the job? What's the contracted end date? What's the projected end date if it's changed, right? What's the draw request amount if there is one? What work has to be completed from the – so just a basic briefing sheet, right? And so the way it works, we meet in our conference room. The PM, project manager, will fill out that briefing sheet for each property, and that's at the top of the file folder for that property. The file folder contains contractor agreement and any other necessary information. But again, Monday, Tuesday, they're going around to all these different properties that are in construction or whatever, taking pictures of them, 30, 40 pictures of each property. And so we sit down, they got a stack of file folders. At 1 o'clock, by 1 o'clock, the pictures are loaded onto the screen in the conference room, and I can click through, and the pictures are in the same order of the file folders, and it works out great. So I open the file, look at the paper, the one-page briefing, I click through the pictures, I say, what do I need to know? And by that point, they will have identified any issues that came up, and they will have a summary or answer or resolution for me. Right. And then we, after that, so Monday, Tuesday, it's prep for the meeting, you know, take pictures, talk to the contractors, deal with any issues. Wednesday morning, it's prep for the meeting, you know, get clarity on situations from contractors, et cetera. Wednesday afternoon, meeting. Wednesday late afternoon, action items. You know, it's send the draw request to the bookkeeper at the front office and she prints the check for me to sign, that kind of stuff. Thursday, Friday, it's a mixture of more action items from the meeting, putting out fires and doing scope walks for new projects. So that's kind of a weekly rhythm. And, you know, there's a lot of supporting documentation for decision-making criteria, you know, replies to inspections, that kind of stuff. But that's how my life works, managing the construction. It works pretty well.
Nice. Well said. How many project managers currently?
Sure. So there's a senior and a junior assistant project manager position. So it's two. Senior and assistant. Senior, we're working on finding a replacement person right now, but there are supposed to be two.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Then my next question on the heels of that, would you be able to touch on your bidding process and awarding of jobs to whether it's a brand new GC or whether you still run even the dedicated GCs through that same process would be important to know up front.
Sure. So I love competition, even for myself, my own business makes you better, right? But there isn't a lot of competition in this side of things, unless I feel like one of the GCs needs an attitude adjustment. And even any of the best ones, they always need attitude adjustments frequently, right? And so I'll talk about how to give them the attitude adjustment later. It depends on their personality. So the bidding process, you know, when we buy a house, you know, the acquisitionist, whoever that was, you know, estimated based on my training, how much the repairs are going to cost. And so when we do that scope walk, it's a 1 or 2 hour meeting with the PM, the GC, and me. And we go through identifying questions. By that point, I've reviewed the comps. I know exactly what that neighborhood calls for to get highest and best use and value out of that property, right? So we have a corresponding budget in the acquisition. I've done my research. I know what the market commands. I know if there's wiggle room in the budget or not, right? And then we go through, it's like a 1 or 2 hour meeting. You know, GC comes with any possible question he can come up with, right? Then what I do is I take out my PM's cell phone, I take a video. I start outside and I just do a scope video. It takes me 5 minutes. And I talk kind of fast, just like I am now. And I go through every single thing we're going to do. Replace all the windows with or without grids, install what kind of siding, et cetera. Then my PM takes that and I guess he pressed start and stop a lot, but he uses we created this Google Forms thing where it kind of, you know, kitchen one, kitchen two, kitchen three, depending which one you select, it auto-populates all the finishes and stuff like that. Same with the flooring and that kind of stuff. And so from that, it becomes like an addendum to the independent contractor agreement for the scope. So it's a meeting, a video, the PM takes the video, creates the scope from there. And honestly, usually we give the budget to the GC. I'd say usually half the time we do. Because, you know, my number isn't going to change. What I'm willing to pay for the job isn't going to change unless maybe we miss something, right? Well, did you notice that the basement wall is caving in, pushing in or something like that? Well, no, I kind of missed that one. So that's a legitimate oversight. And that's our scope and budgeting creation process in terms of awarding the job. And this is going to shock you, but we rarely have more than one contractor bid a job. It's crazy because I know it should cost. I know what it should cost. And so at this point, you know, these guys were all relatively on the same page with regards to cost for the jobs and different things. And so I award them based on geography, you know, where the GC is located, based on their current workload, what's finishing soon, what else is coming down the pike. And so I try to keep their best interest in mind because it helps me as well so that, you know, they're not doing jobs spread out way all over, right? I don't want two GCs working at two different houses, you know, a half a mile apart. That'd just be a waste. So I try to keep geography and workload in mind based on who I assign it to. That's my main decision-making process once I've pre-screened somebody. Then if I need somebody new, yeah, I don't hire them until I know that my, you know, loyal guys are taken care of.
Gotcha. That's a great segue into the next piece I wanted to talk about. Bad contractors, attitude adjustments, firing a contractor if necessary halfway through the job. When do you know that it's time to fire a contractor? And how do you go about that? You know, the bad side, getting out of the nightmare, which, you know, they described the situation with Scott right on the front end. And I'm sure there are a lot of lessons for you in that, Jim. I mean, if that was to pop up again, based on that pain and experience, I'm sure you've been able to cut that off, you know, nip that in a bud. So could you touch on all of that for me?
Sure. So let's talk about the good contractors that need attitude adjustments, right? You know, contractors, bless their hearts, they just, emotional intelligence isn't usually the number one key character trait, right? They're great technicians and sometimes really, really honest guys, but, you know, controlling your temper, controlling your mouth, and controlling your attitude, like, you don't get pissy with me. Like, I give you $2 million of work per year, don't get pissy with me or my PM, right? So what I always try to do is take the emotion out of the situation, right? If there's an issue, there's a few different things to do. I deal with it when they're emotional. That's rule number one. Rule number two is when I make that phone call to deal with the issue, you know, they're expecting the phone call. They're expecting a confrontation. And so what I try to do is take the confrontation out of the phone call, meaning I get on the same page. I say, hey, man, I know we got a challenge to deal with. Really what I'm trying to do here is just get clarity in the situation and figure out something that makes us all happy so we all know we're being treated right. Well, how can you deny that? How can you be angry if someone's saying that? So I try to get the first word out, and that's my first word, something along those lines. And then I just deal with the issue itself. Maybe it was a dispute over an extra, a dispute whether or not he's ready for the next draw or something like that, right? That's typically how I deal with it. But then if it still gets a little pissy, like if he's just like going hog wild crazy with all the extras and all this kind of stuff, I mean, I just scale back their load. I just scale back their workload. You know, hey, you know, I'm doing 7 projects. Hey, I'm wrapping up two. Do you think I got 2 new replacements? Ah, you know what? With all these extras keep piling up, having a hard time, you know, going over budget so much, starting to keep it in the 4 to 5 projects at a time kind of range. Whoa, what did that just tell them? More than anything else I ever could have said been hollering and screaming, they're going to think twice before they ever charge me for an extra again, right? And so it's like once or twice a year I got to have that conversation with the GCs, right? And depending on how bad they've been, I might withdraw more work for longer, right? That's the, in my experience, kind of the only way to work with them, the only way to get to have an attitude adjustment, because they're always right. They never think you're right. They think they're always right. And so you got to talk to them the only way they understand, which is, you know, money. And I say that about the best guys, you know. So then for firing contractors, there's one rule that if you keep this rule, it will just solve 98% of your problems. You know, I've got 2 of my 4 or 5 main GCs. I mean, they're the kind of guys I can leave them with my wallet. Say, listen, I'm going to be out of town for a week. Just hold on to my wallet for me. I'll be back in a week. And I know, like, I would sleep perfectly well. I'd be fine, right? So I trust them with my life, with my wallet, whatever. But I still keep them honest on the contract. So the simple rule is this, and it's pretty obvious. I'm sure you know what it is. Don't get too far behind your contractor, right? So you keep them honest with the draw schedule. So if I've got a GC I've done a lot of deals with, and it's a 70 grand project, we're talking about 5 draws, right? If it's a brand new contractor, we're talking about, I don't know, 7 to 10 draws for that same job, right? Which means we got to be out there, be a little quicker with the money. It might slow the job down a little bit. I don't care. It's cool. But we have that expectation up front. So for instance, you know, recently I mentioned that we've had a few, 2 or 3 contractors skip out on jobs. Well, the most it ever cost us was 5 grand. On one project, meaning what we paid the first GC, and then what we paid the good GC to come in and clean up the mess. The whole cost was no more than 5 grand over budget. And I think that's really good. So 1 was 2, 1 was 3, 1 was 5. That's pretty dang good considering, you know, the potential can of worms right there. And the only reason that happened was because we watch our draw schedules. You know, we look at that carefully as to how much work is done between draws. So I always ask myself, if I write this check right now and he skips down tomorrow morning, how much money is that going to cost me? And if I can't live with that answer when I'm creating the draw schedule, then I restructure it, right? So obviously, if you're going to fire a contractor halfway through their job, usually they want out of the job by that point, right? I mean, I've never fired a contractor and he got upset for firing them, right? Is that they want it. They're out of money. They realize they underbid the job. They're just hating life. They just want out. And so if they know they can get out without being sued, without, you know, having to write a check, they're thrilled. And so the way we do that is, you know, we simply go to them on the job one day. We don't give them a heads up. We go to the job with new locks in tow. We go to the job with a lien release waiver and a notary and say, listen, man, I need you to, this isn't working out. It's no secret. Love you like a brother, but you can't work here anymore. Get your stuff. Sign a lien release waiver. You sign this, we're done and we're cool. No, I mean, we're probably not going to be working together anymore, but you don't have to worry about me chasing you and you're not going back on the project. You're not going to come to look to me for more money or anything like that. You know, we're done, but we're cool. And they just love it. It's on the way out. Notary notarizes it. They get a copy. I get a copy. Change the locks. Take pictures of the materials that are in the house and leave. And you know, they leave. And of course, usually by then I had another contractor lined up to come over.
How long is the period of time, Jim, from like when you start to notice there's a problem? I mean, does it develop over a week? Do you immediately sense danger as soon as they start the project? I mean, what are some of the red herrings that the guy's a problem?
Yeah, honestly, two out of the three that I fired, I went against my gut instinct, but we kind of needed a contractor. The guys were all busy, so that was the first rule I broke. But generally speaking, it's 1 to 3 weeks from when stuff starts to fall apart to when you know you got to make it. I've heard that. I think Dan Kennedy says this, hire slow, fire fast. And if you just adopt that mentality for contractors, get there as soon as possible. And, you know, I'm sure you've learned this lesson. You know, the worst number you can have in any business, in any part of your business is one. Because when you have one contractor, one lender, one acquisitionist, one anybody, then you're relying on that person and they know it and they'll manipulate you.
Yeah, that's smart. That's absolutely brilliant to bring the lien release, the notary, and the new locks, and the pictures of materials. What is it that you're trying to head off there or protect yourself against by taking pictures of the materials during this interchange?
Because they can break back in, steal the shit, and then return it, get a couple more grand out of the project, and who's to say it was ever there?
Do you make a production out of, like, photographing the materials right in front of the guy as part
absolutely.
Of this, like, the choreography? Him
absolutely.
Seeing you take photos so he... Gotcha.
Yes.
It's a positioning.
Yes. And if I try to, if I can, we catch them in the picture too.
Nice.
Yeah. Just to make them nervous.
Fair enough. I just want to follow up here. And do you have any other insights, thoughts to jump to mind, questions that I should have asked or, you know, topics I should have brought up surrounding the contractor piece that we covered on our discussion here, Jim?
So really, I'd just say a couple, you know, parting piece of advice rather is, you know, one, make sure you do enough upfront due diligence on your contractors. And I hate to say, I'm a very optimistic person, but you can't trust anybody, right? And so you got to act, you know, say, what if this person had to screw me tomorrow? How bad off would I be? And then you identify, you can live with that situation. So just all the same things. Most 90% of what I talked about here was preventing this. You know, these challenges, right? The pre-screening, the gut feeling, the draw schedules, the references, all that kind of stuff. If you do that stuff, you'll avoid the quote unquote contractor nightmares. And that's how, you know, and you got to protect yourself with the draw schedules. That's honestly the biggest things I could keep in mind for you. You know, the stuff in terms of management, that's more applies to folks who are already got contractors, but their life is heck because they've got so many of them. And, you know, hopefully it's kind of two different audiences we're talking to on the same podcast. So hopefully, you know, both got a lot of value out of it.
Yeah. And we also didn't touch on, but one of the huge lessons that I think I gained here that, I mean, I've gained myself in my own experience, but that should be noted for anybody who maybe is thinking about flipping properties or doing like one of the huge values that Jim Zaspel brings to the table and Dan Breslin brings to the table is a pipeline of work and the potential for millions of dollars worth in contracting. So, you know, the lesson in all that, if you did not pick that up, would be to make sure that you're going to flip multiple houses. Jim,
yeah.
You do some coaching and stuff. I mean, do you advise if someone's getting in, do one rehab? I mean, what's kind of like the ramp up speed to, you know, build the rehabbing business for somebody?
I mean, if you're going to do one, there's no reason you shouldn't be doing five, in my opinion, because it's easy to do more than less. And, you know, you cross that line at a certain point in either direction, but you got to be doing a handful at a time. Because that way you don't need one deal too much. You know, what if the city thought it's going to make 30 grand, winds up only making 10, you know, is your family going to eat, right? Are you going to, You know, was that had you already mentally spent that 30 grand? And so if for no other reason, your personal budget, having more projects is good, but it is absolutely true that having a bunch of projects per year builds a ton of loyalty more than anything else with your contract. Well, that and paying well and paying consistently.
Yeah, you got to pay them.
There is that detail. So those two things, I think, are pretty dang essential, yes.
Okay, a few minutes ago you mentioned the checklist for pre-screening contractors. Do you have some other information, contact info, somewhere people can go to get that, Jim?
Sure. Yeah. So what I'm doing for your listeners here is they just go to jimsrehabchecklist.com. That's J-I-M-S rehabchecklist.com. That's my contractor pre-screening checklist. And I think you and your audience will find that really, really helpful. It's kind of my gift to you and to them. And of course, my blog, if anybody feels so inclined, put a lot of cool content on there. It's just jimzastel.com.
All right. Cool, Jim. Hey, I really appreciate you taking the time out today right after your contractor meeting. I think we're on a Wednesday here recording this. I got a ton of great insight and notes here, and I'm sure the listeners do as well. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. Always good to talk to you and good to catch up.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving an email notification the next time an episode is released? You can either sign up at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe through one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, amongst others. Do you have investment capital not already earning above average returns? If you're interested in checking out some upcoming private mortgage opportunities I have available in Chicago, Atlanta, Florida, and the Philadelphia market, go to www.superchargedreturns.com. You'll also receive instant access to the audio on how to create tax-free real estate investments. You can also check out the profitable real estate deals we have at that site as well. Finally, if you have certain questions or topics you'd like discussed on a future episode, or you have a guest suggestion, somebody that you would like me to invite on the show, contact me by clicking on the Contact Dan link at www.reidiamonds.com. And thanks again for being a loyal listener of the show. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.